Very well, said Bliss, with a sudden brilliant smile. Earth is the world where our forebears came from, Phelim. Yours and mine, and Pell's and Trevise's. Yours, Bliss, and mine also? Phelim sounded puzzled. Both of them? There's just one set of forebears, said Bliss. We had the same forebears, all of us. Trevise said, It sounds to me as though the child knows very well that she's different from us. Bliss said to Trevise in a low voice, Don't say that. She must be made to see she isn't, not in essentials. Hermaphrodism is essential, I should think. I'm talking about the mind. Transducer lobes are essential, too. Now, Trevise, don't be difficult. She's intelligent and human, regardless of details. She turned to Phelim, her voice rising to its normal level. Think quietly about this, Phelim, and see what it means to you. Your forebears and mine were the same. All the people on all the worlds, many, many worlds, all had the same forebears. And those forebears lived originally on the world named Earth. That means we're all relatives, doesn't it? Now, go back to our room and think of that. Phelim, after bestowing a thoughtful look on Trevise, turned and ran off, hastened on by Bliss's affectionate slap on her backside. Bliss turned to Trevise and said, Please, Trevise, promise me you won't make any comments in her hearing that will lead her to think she's different from us. Trevise said, I promise. I have no wish to impede or subvert the educational procedure. But, you know, she is different from us. In ways, as I am different from you, and as Pell is. Don't be naive, Bliss. The differences in Phelim's case are much greater. A little greater. The similarities are vastly more important. She and her people will be part of Galaxia someday, and a very useful part, I'm sure. All right, we won't argue. He turned to the computer with clear reluctance. And meanwhile, I'm afraid I have to check the supposed position of Earth in real space. Afraid? Well, Trevise lifted his shoulders in what he hoped was a half-humorous way. What if there's no suitable star near the place? Then there isn't, said Bliss. I'm wondering if there's any point in checking it out now. We won't be able to make a jump for several days. And you'll be spending them agonizing over the possibilities. Find out now. Waiting won't change matters. Trevise sat there with his lips compressed for a moment, then said, You're right. Very well, then. Here goes. He turned to the computer, placed his hands on the hand marks on the desk, and the view screen went dark. Bliss said, I'll leave you then. I'll make you nervous if I stay. She left with a wave of her hand. The thing is, he muttered, that we're going to be checking the computer's galactic map first, and even if Earth's sun is in the calculated position, the map should not include it. But we'll then... His voice trailed off in astonishment as the view screen flashed with a background of stars. These were fairly numerous and dim, with an occasional brighter one sparkling here and there, well scattered over the face of the screen. But quite close to the center was a star that was brighter than all the rest. We've got it, said Pellerat jubilantly. We've got it, old chap. Look how bright it is. Any star at centered coordinates would look bright, said Trevise. clearly trying to fight off any initial jubilation that might prove unfounded. The view, after all, is presented from a distance of a parsec from the centered coordinates. Still, that centered star certainly isn't a red dwarf, or a red giant, or a hot blue-white. Wait for information. The computer is checking its databanks. There was silence for a few seconds, and then Trevise said, "Spectral class G2. Another pause, then. "Diameter 1.4 million kilometers. Mass 1.02 times that of Terminus's sun. Surface temperature 6,000 absolute. Rotation slow, just under 30 days. No unusual activity or irregularity." Pellerat said, "Isn't all that typical of the kind of star about which habitable planets are to be found?" "Typical," said Trevise, nodding in the dimness. "And therefore what we'd expect Earth's sun to be like. If that is where life developed, the sun of Earth would have set the original standard." "So there is a reasonable chance that there would be a habitable planet circling it." "We don't have to speculate about that," said Trevise, who sounded puzzled indeed over the matter. "The galactic map lists it as possessing a planet with human life, but with a question mark." Pellerat's enthusiasm grew. "That's exactly what we would expect, Golan. The life-bearing planet is there, but the attempt to hide the fact obscures data concerning it and leaves the makers of the map the computer uses uncertain." "No, that's what bothers me," said Trevise. "That's not what we should expect. We should expect far more than that. Considering the efficiency with which data concerning Earth has been wiped out, the makers of the map should not have known that life exists in the system, let alone human life. They should not even have known Earth's sun exists. The spacer worlds aren't on the map. Why should Earth's sun be?" "Well, it's there just the same. What's the use of arguing the fact? What other information about the star is given?" "A name." "Ah, what is it?" "Alpha." There was a short pause, and then Pellerat said eagerly, "That's it, old man. That's the final bit of evidence. Consider the meaning." "Does it have a meaning?" said Trevise. "It's just a name to me, and an odd one. It doesn't sound galactic." "It isn't galactic. It's in a prehistoric language of Earth, the same one that gave us Gaia as the name of Bliss's planet." "What does Alpha mean, then?" "Alpha is the first letter of the alphabet of that ancient language. That is one of the most firmly attested scraps of knowledge we have about it. In ancient times, Alpha was sometimes used to mean the first of anything. To call a sun Alpha implies that it's the first sun. And wouldn't the first sun be the one around which a planet revolved that was the first planet to bear human life? Earth?"
"Are you sure of that?"
"Absolutely," said Pellerat. "Is there anything in early legends, you're the mythologist after all, that gives Earth's sun some very unusual attribute?"
"No, how can there be? It has to be standard by definition, and the characteristics the computer has given us are as standard as possible, I imagine, aren't they?"
"Earth's sun is a single star, I suppose." Pellerat said,
"Well, of course. As far as I know, all inhabited worlds orbit single stars."
"So I would have thought myself," said Trevise. "So I would have thought myself," said Trevise. "The trouble is that that star in the center of the view screen is not a single star. It is a binary. The brighter of the two stars making up the binary is indeed Standard, and it is that one for which the computer supplied us with data. Circling that star, with a period of roughly 80 years, however, is another star with a mass 4/5 that of the brighter one. We can't see the two as separate stars with the unaided eye, but if I were to enlarge the view, I'm sure we would.
Are you certain of that, Golan? Said Pellerat, taken aback.
It's what the computer is telling me, and if we are looking at a binary star, then it's not Earth's sun. It can't be.
71.
Trevise broke contact with the computer, and the lights brightened. That was the signal, apparently, for Bliss to return, with Phalum tagging after her.
Well, then, what are the results? She asked.
Trevise said tonelessly, Somewhat disappointing. Where I expected to find Earth's sun, I found a binary star instead. Earth's sun is a single star, so the one centered is not it.
Pellerat said, Now what, Golan?
Trevise shrugged. I didn't really expect to see Earth's sun centered. Even the spacers wouldn't settle worlds in such a way as to set up an exact sphere. Aurora, the oldest of the spacer worlds, might have sent out settlers of its own, and that may have distorted the sphere, too. Then, too, Earth's sun may not have moved at precisely the average velocity of the spacer worlds.
Pellerat said, So the Earth can be anywhere. Is that what you're saying?
No, not quite anywhere. All these possible sources of error can't amount to much. Earth's sun must be in the vicinity of the coordinates. The star we've spotted almost exactly at the coordinates must be a neighbor of Earth's sun. It's startling that there should be a neighbor that so closely resembles Earth's sun, except for being a binary, but that must be the case.
But we would see Earth's sun on the map then, wouldn't we? I mean, near Alpha?
No, for I'm certain Earth's sun isn't on the map at all. It was that which shook my confidence when we first spied Alpha. Regardless of how much it might resemble Earth's sun, the mere fact that it was on the map made me suspect it was not the real thing.
Well then, said Bliss, why not concentrate on the same coordinates in real space? Then, if there is any bright star close to the center, a star that does not exist in the computer's map, and if it is very much like Alpha in its properties, but is single, might it not be Earth's sun?
Trevise sighed. If all that were so, I'd be willing to wager half my fortune, such as it is, that circling that star you speak of would be the planet Earth. Again, I hesitate to try.
Because you might fail?
Trevise nodded. However, he said, just give me a moment or two to catch my breath, and I'll force myself to do so. And while the three adults looked at each other, Phalum approached the computer desk and stared curiously at the hand marks upon it. She reached out her own hand tentatively toward the markings, and Trevise blocked the motion with a swift outthrusting of his own arm and a sharp, "Mustn't touch, Phalum." The young Solarian seemed startled and retreated to the comfort of Bliss's encircling arm.
Pellerat said, "We must face it, Golan. What if you find nothing in real space?"
Then we will be forced to go back to the earlier plan, said Trevise, and visit each of the 47 spacer worlds in turn.
And if that yields nothing, Golan?
Trevise shook his head in annoyance, as though to prevent that thought from taking too deep a root. Staring down at his knees, he said abruptly,
Then I will think of something else.
But what if there is no world of forebears at all?
Trevise looked up sharply at the treble voice.
Who said that? He asked.
It was a useless question, The moment of disbelief faded, and he knew very well who the questioner was.
"I did," said Phelim.
Trevise looked at her with a slight frown. "Did you understand the conversation?" Phelim said,
"You are looking for the world of forebears, but you haven't found it yet. Maybe there isn't no such world."
"Any such world," said Bliss softly. "No, Phelim," said Trevise seriously. "There has been a very big effort to hide it. To try so hard to hide something means there is something there to hide. Do you understand what I am saying?"
"Yes," said Phelim. "You do not let me touch the hands on the desk. Because you do not let me do that means it would be interesting to touch them."
"Ah, but not for you, Phelim. Bliss, you are creating a monster that will destroy us all. Don't ever let her in here unless I'm at the desk. And even then, think twice, will you?" The small byplay, however, seemed to have shaken him out of his irresolution. He said, "Obviously, I had better get to work. If I just sit here, uncertain as to what to do, that little fright will take over the ship." The lights dimmed, and Bliss said in a low voice,
"You promised, Trevise. Do not call her a monster or a fright in her hearing."
"Then keep an eye on her and teach her some manners. Tell her children should be never heard and seldom seen." Bliss frowned.
"Your attitude toward children is simply appalling, Trevise."
"Maybe, but this is not the time to discuss the matter." Then he said, in tones in which satisfaction and relief were equally represented, "There's Alpha again in real space, and to its left and slightly upward is almost as bright a star, and one that isn't in the computer's galactic map. That is Earth's sun. I'll wager all my fortune on it." 72.
"Well, now," said Bliss, "we won't take any part of your fortune if you lose, so why not settle the matter in a forthright manner? Let's visit the star as soon as you can make the jump."
Trevise shook his head. "No, this time it's not a matter of irresolution or fear. It's a matter of being careful. 3 times we've visited an unknown world, and 3 times we've come up against something unexpectedly dangerous. And 3 times, moreover, we've had to leave that world in a hurry. This time, the matter is ultimately crucial, and I will not play my cards in ignorance again, or at least in any more ignorance than I can help. So far, all we have are vague stories about radioactivity, and that is not enough. By an odd chance that no one could have anticipated, there is a planet with human life about a parsec from Earth."
"Do we really know that Alpha has a planet with human life on it?" put in Pellerat. "You said the computer placed a question mark after that."
"Even so," said Trevise, "it's worth trying. Why not take a look at it? If it does indeed have human beings on it, let us find out what they know about Earth. For them, after all, Earth is not a distant thing of legend. It is a neighbor world, bright and prominent in their sky." Bliss said thoughtfully,
"It's not a bad idea. It occurs to me that if Alpha is inhabited, and if the inhabitants are not your thoroughly typical isolates, they may be friendly, and we might be able to get some decent food for a change."
"And meet some pleasant people," said Trevise. "Don't forget that. Will it be all right with you, Genoff?" Pellerat said,
"You make the decision, old chap. Wherever you go, I will go too."
Phelim said suddenly,
"Will we find Jemby?"
Bliss said hastily before Trevise could answer,
We will look for it, Phelim.
And then Trevise said, It's settled then. On to Alpha. 73.
Two big stars, said Phelim, pointing to the viewscreen.
That's right, said Trevise. Two of them. Bliss, do keep an eye on her. I don't want her fiddling with anything.
She's fascinated by machinery, said Bliss.
Yes, I know she is, said Trevise. But I'm not fascinated by her fascination. Though, to tell you the truth, I'm as fascinated as she is at seeing two stars that bright in the viewscreen at the same time.
The two stars were bright enough to seem to be on the point of showing a disk, each of them.
The screen had automatically increased filtration density in order to remove the hard radiation and dim the light of the bright stars so as to avoid retinal damage. As a result, few other stars were bright enough to be noticeable, and the two that were reigned in haughty near isolation.
The thing is, said Trevise, I've never been this close to a binary system before.
You haven't? Said Pellerat, open astonishment in his voice. How is that possible?
Trevise laughed. I've been around, Janoff, but I'm not the galactic rover you think I am.
Pellerat said, I was never in space at all till I met you, Golan. But I always thought that anyone who did manage to get into space would go everywhere.
I know, that's natural enough.
The trouble with planet-bound people is that no matter how much their mind may tell them otherwise, their imaginations just can't take in the true size of the galaxy. We could travel all our lives and leave most of the galaxy unpenetrated and untouched. Besides, no one ever goes to binaries.
Why not? Said Bliss, frowning. We on Gaia know little astronomy compared to the traveling isolates of the galaxy, but I'm under the impression that binaries aren't rare.
They're not, said Trevise. There are substantially more binaries than there are single stars. However, the formation of two stars in close association upsets the ordinary processes of planetary formation. Binaries have less planetary material than single stars do. Such planets as do form about them often have relatively unstable orbits and are very rarely of a type that is reasonably habitable. Early explorers, I imagine, studied many binaries at close range. But after a while, for settlement purposes, they sought out only singles. And, of course, once you have a densely settled galaxy, virtually all travel involves trade and communications and is carried on between inhabited worlds circling single stars. In periods of military activity, I suppose bases were sometimes set up on small, otherwise uninhabited worlds, circling one of the stars of a binary that happened to be strategically placed. But as hyperspatial travel came to be perfected, such bases were no longer necessary.
Pellerat said humbly, It's amazing how much I don't know.
Trevise merely grinned. Don't let that impress you, Janoff. When I was in the Navy, we listened to an incredible number of lectures on outmoded military tactics that no one ever planned or intended to use and were just talked about out of inertia. I was just rattling off a bit of one of them. Consider all you know about mythology, folklore, and archaic languages that I don't know, and that only you and a very few others do know.
Bliss said, Yes, but those two stars make up a binary system, and one of them has an inhabited planet circling it.
We hope it does, Bliss, said Trevise. Everything has its exceptions. And with an official question mark in this case, which makes it more puzzling. No, Phelim, those knobs are not toys. Bliss, either keep her in handcuffs or take her out.
She won't hurt anything, said Bliss defensively,
but pulled the Salarian youngster to herself just the same.
If you're so interested in that habitable planet, why aren't we there already?
For one thing, said Trevise, I'm just human enough to want to see this sight of a binary system at close quarters. Then, too, I'm just human enough to be cautious. As I've already explained, nothing has happened since we left Gaia that would encourage me to be anything but cautious. Pellerat said, Which one of those stars is Alpha, Golan? We won't get lost, Yadov. The computer knows exactly which one is Alpha. And, for that matter, so do we. It's the hotter and yellower of the two because it's the larger. Now, the one on the right has a distinct orange tinge to its light. Rather like Aurora's sun, if you recall. Do you notice?
Yes, now that you call it to my attention.
Very well. That's the smaller one. What's the second letter of that ancient language you speak of?
Pellerat thought a moment and said, Beta.
Then let's call the orange one Beta and the yellow-white one Alpha, and it's Alpha we're heading for right now.
Chapter 17, New Earth. 74.
Four planets, muttered Trevise. All are small, plus a trailing off of asteroids. No gas giants.
Pellerat said, Do you find that disappointing?
Not really. It's expected. Binaries that circle each other at small distances can have no planets circling one of the stars. Planets can circle the center of gravity of both, but it's very unlikely that they would be habitable, too far away. On the other hand, if the binaries are reasonably separate, there can be planets in stable orbits about each, if they are close enough to one or the other of the stars. These two stars, according to the computer's databank, have an average separation of 3.5 billion kilometers, and even at periastron, when they are closest together, are about 1.7 billion kilometers apart. A planet in an orbit of less than 200 million kilometers from either star would be stably situated, but there can be no planet with a larger orbit. That means no gas giants, since they would have to be farther away from a star. But what's the difference? Gas giants aren't habitable anyway.
But one of those four planets might be habitable.
Actually, the second planet is the only real possibility. For one thing, it's the only one of them large enough to have an atmosphere. They approached the second planet rapidly, and over a period of 2 days, its image expanded. At first, with a majestic and measured swelling. And then, when there was no sign of any ship emerging to intercept them, with increasing and almost frightening speed. The far star was moving swiftly along a temporary orbit, 1,000 kilometers above the cloud cover, when Trevise said grimly, I see why the computer's memory banks put a question mark after the notation that it was inhabited. There's no clear sign of radiation, either light in the night hemisphere or radio anywhere.
The cloud cover seems pretty thick, said Pellerat.
That should not blank out radio radiation. They watched the planet wheeling below them, a symphony in swirling white clouds, through occasional gaps of which a bluish wash indicated ocean.
Trevise said, The cloud level is fairly heavy for an inhabited world. It might be a rather gloomy one.
What bothers me most, he added, as they plunged once more into the night shadow, is that no space stations have hailed us.
The way they did back at Camporeon, you mean? Said Pellerat.
The way they would in any inhabited world. We would have to stop for the usual checkup on papers, freight, length of stay, and so on.
Bliss said, Perhaps we missed the hail for some reason.
Our computer would have received it at any wavelength they might have cared to use, and we've been sending out our own signals, but have roused no one, and nothing as a result. Dipping under the cloud layer without communicating with station officials violates space courtesy, but I don't see that we have a choice. The Far Star slowed and strengthened its anti-gravity accordingly so as to maintain its height. It came out into the sunlight again and slowed further. Treviz, in coordination with the computer, found a sizable break in the clouds. The ship sank and passed through it. Beneath them heaved the ocean in what must have been a fresh breeze. It lay wrinkled several kilometers below them, faintly striped in lines of froth. They flew out of the sunlit patch and under the cloud cover. The expanse of water immediately beneath them turned a slate gray, and the temperature dropped noticeably. Phelim, staring at the viewscreen, spoke in her own consonant-rich language for a few moments, then shifted to Galactic. Her voice trembled.
"What is that which I see beneath?"
"That is an ocean," said Bliss soothingly. "It is a very large mass of water."
"Why does it not dry up?"
Bliss looked at Treviz, who said, "There's too much water for it to dry up." Phelim said in a half-choked manner,
"I don't want all that water. Let us go away."
And then she shrieked thinly as the Far Star moved through a patch of storm clouds, so that the viewscreen turned milky and was streaked with the mark of raindrops. The lights in the pilot room dimmed, and the ship's motion became slightly jerky. Treviz looked up in surprise and cried out, "Bliss, your Phelim is old enough to transduce. She's using electric power to try to manipulate the controls. Stop her." Bliss put her arms about Phelim and hugged her tightly.
"It's all right, Phelim. It's all right. There's nothing to be afraid of. It's just another world, that's all. There are many like this."
Phelim relaxed somewhat, but continued to tremble. Bliss said to Treviz,
"The child has never seen an ocean, and perhaps, for all I know, never experienced fog or rain. Can't you be sympathetic?"
"Not if she tampers with the ship. She's a danger to all of us then. Take her into your room and calm her down." Bliss nodded curtly. Pellerat said, "I'll come with you, Bliss."
"No, no, Pell," she responded. "You stay here. I'll soothe Phelim and you soothe Treviz."
And she left. "I don't need soothing," growled Treviz to Pellerat. "I'm sorry if I flew off the handle, but we can't have a child playing with the controls, can we?"
"Of course we can't," said Pellerat. But Bliss was caught by surprise. "She can control Phelim, who is really remarkably well-behaved for a child taken from her home and her robot and thrown willy-nilly into a life she doesn't understand."
"I know. It wasn't I who wanted to take her along, remember? It was Bliss's idea."
"Yes, but the child would have been killed if we hadn't taken her."
"Well, I'll apologize to Bliss later on. To the child, too." But he was still frowning, and Pellerat said gently,
"Golan, old chap, is there anything else bothering you?"
"The ocean," said Treviz.
They had long emerged from the rainstorm, but the clouds persisted.
"What's wrong with it?" asked Pellerat.
"There's too much of it, that's all." Pellerat looked blank, and Treviz said with a snap, "No land. We haven't seen any land. The atmosphere is perfectly normal, oxygen and nitrogen in decent proportions, so the planet has to be engineered, and there has to be plant life to maintain the oxygen level. In the natural state, such atmospheres do not occur, except presumably on Earth where it developed, who knows how. But then on engineered planets, there are always reasonable amounts of dry land, up to one-third of the whole, and never less than a fifth.
So how can this planet be engineered and lack land?
Pellerat said,
Perhaps, since this planet is part of a binary system, it is completely atypical. Maybe it wasn't engineered, but evolved an atmosphere in ways that never prevail on planets about single stars. Perhaps life developed independently here, as it once did on Earth, but only sea life.
Even if we were to admit that, said Trevise, it would do us no good. There's no way life in the sea can develop a technology. Technology is always based on fire, and fire is impossible in the sea. A life-bearing planet without technology is not what we're looking for.
I realize that, but I'm only considering ideas. After all, as far as we know, technology only developed once, on Earth. Everywhere else, the settlers brought it with them. You can't say technology is always anything if you only have one case to study.
Travel through the sea requires streamlining. Sea life cannot have irregular outlines and appendages such as hands.
Squids have tentacles.
Trevise said, I admit we're allowed to speculate. But if you're thinking of intelligent squid-like creatures evolving independently somewhere in the galaxy and developing a technology not based on fire, you're supposing something not at all likely, in my opinion.
In your opinion, said Pellerat gently.
Suddenly, Trevise laughed. Very well, Janoff. I see your logic chopping in order to get even with me for speaking harshly to Bliss, and you're doing a good job. I promise you that if we find no land, we will examine the sea as best we can to see if we can find your civilized squids. As he spoke, the ship plunged into the night shadow again, and the viewscreen turned black.
Pellerat winced. I keep wondering, he said, is this safe?
Is what safe, Janoff?
Racing through the dark like this. We might dip and dive into the ocean and be destroyed instantly.
Quite impossible, Janoff, really. The computer keeps us traveling along a gravitational line of force. In other words, it remains always at a constant intensity of the planetary gravitational force, which means it keeps us at a nearly constant height above sea level.
But how high?
Nearly 5 kilometers.
That doesn't really console me, Golan. Might we not reach land and smash into a mountain we don't see?
We don't see, but ship's radar will see it, and the computer will guide the ship around or over the mountain.
What if there's level land, then? We'll miss it in the dark.
No, Janoff, we won't. Radar reflected from water is not at all like radar reflected from land. Water is essentially flat. Land is rough. For that reason, reflection from land is substantially more chaotic than reflection from water. The computer will know the difference, and it will let me know if there's land in view. Even if it were day and the planet were sunlit, the computer might well detect land before I would. They fell silent, and in a couple of hours they were back in daylight, with an empty ocean again rolling beneath them monotonously, but occasionally invisible when they passed through one of the numerous storms. In one storm, the wind drove the far star out of its path. The computer gave way, Trevise explained, in order to prevent an unnecessary waste of energy and to minimize the chance of physical damage. Then, when the turbulence had passed, the computer eased the ship back into its path.
Probably the edge of a hurricane, said Trevise.
Pellerat said,
See here, old chap. We're just traveling west to east, or east to west. All we're examining is the equator.
Trevise said, That would be foolish, wouldn't it? We're following a great circle route, northwest, southeast.
That takes us through the tropics and both temperate zones. And each time we repeat the circle, the path moves westward as the planet rotates on its axis beneath us. We're methodically crisscrossing the world. By now, since we haven't hit land, the chances of a sizable continent are less than 1 in 10, according to the computer, and of a sizable island less than 1 in 4, with the chances going down each circle we make.
"You know what I would have done," said Pellerat slowly, as the night hemisphere engulfed them again. "I'd have stayed well away from the planet and swept the entire hemisphere facing me with radar. The clouds wouldn't have mattered, would they?"
Trevise said, "And then zoom to the other side and do the same there. Or just let the planet turn once." "That's hindsight, Janoff. Who would expect to approach a habitable planet without stopping at a station and being given a path, or being excluded? And if one went under the cloud layer without stopping at a station, who would expect not to find land almost at once? Habitable planets are land."
"Surely not all land," said Pellerat.
"I'm not talking about that," said Trevise in sudden excitement. "I'm saying we've found land. Quiet." Then, with a restraint that did not succeed in hiding his excitement, Trevise placed his hands on the desk and became part of the computer. He said, "It's an island about 250 kilometers long and 65 kilometers wide, more or less. Perhaps 15,000 square kilometers in area or thereabout. Not large, but respectable. More than a dot on the map. Wait." The lights in the pilot room dimmed and went out.
"What are we doing?"
said Pellerat, automatically whispering as though darkness were something fragile that must not be shattered.
"Waiting for our eyes to undergo dark adaptation."
"The ship is hovering over the island. Just watch. Do you see anything?"
"No. Little specks of light, maybe. I'm not sure."
"I see them, too. Now I'll throw in the telescopic lens." And there was light, clearly visible, irregular patches of it.
"It's inhabited," said Trevise. "It may be the only inhabited portion of the planet." "What do we do?"
"We wait for daytime. That gives us a few hours in which we can rest."
"Might they not attack us?"
"With what? I detect almost no radiation except visible light and infrared. It's inhabited, and the inhabitants are clearly intelligent. They have a technology, but obviously a pre-electronic one, so I don't think there's anything to worry about up here. If I should be wrong, the computer will warn me in plenty of time."
"And once daylight comes?"
"We'll land, of course." 75. They came down when the first rays of the morning sun shone through a break in the clouds to reveal part of the island. Freshly green, with its interior marked by a line of low rolling hills stretching into the purplish distance. As they dropped closer, they could see isolated copses of trees and occasional orchards, but for the most part, there were well-kept farms. Immediately below them, on the southeastern shore of the island, was a silvery beach backed by a broken line of boulders, and beyond it was a stretch of lawn. They caught a glimpse of an occasional house, but these did not cluster into anything like a town. Eventually, they made out a dim network of roads, sparsely lined by dwelling places. And then, in the cool morning air, they spied an air car in the far distance. They could only tell it was an air car and not a bird by the manner of its maneuvering. It was the first indubitable sign of intelligent life in action they had yet seen on the planet. "It could be an automated vehicle, if they could manage that without electronics," said Trevise. Bliss said, "It might well be.
It seems to me that if there were a human being at the controls, it would be heading for us. We must be quite a sight. A vehicle sinking downward without the use of braking jets of rocket fire.
A strange sight on any planet, said Trevise thoughtfully. There can't be many worlds that have ever witnessed the descent of a gravitic space vessel. The beach would make a fine landing place, but if the winds blow, I don't want the ship inundated. I'll make for the stretch of grass on the other side of the boulders.
At least, said Pellerat, a gravitic ship won't scorch private property in descending.
Down they came gently on the four broad pads that had moved slowly outward during the last stage. These pressed down into the soil under the weight of the ship.
Pellerat said, I'm afraid we'll leave marks, though.
At least, said Bliss, and there was that in her voice that was not entirely approving, the climate is evidently equable. I would even say warm.
A human being was on the grass, watching the ship descend, and showing no evidence of fear or surprise. The look on her face showed only rapt interest. She wore very little, which accounted for Bliss's estimate of the climate. Her sandals seemed to be of canvas, and about her hips was a wraparound skirt with a flowered pattern. There were no leg coverings, and there was nothing above her waist. Her hair was black, long, and very glossy, descending almost to her waist. Her skin color was a pale brown, and her eyes were narrow. Trevise scanned the surroundings, and there was no other human being in sight. He shrugged and said, Well, it's early morning, and the inhabitants may be mostly indoors, or even asleep. Still, I wouldn't say it was a well-populated area. He turned to the others and said, I'll go out and talk to the woman, if she speaks anything comprehensible. The rest of you...
I should think, said Bliss firmly, that we might as well all step out. That woman looks completely harmless, and in any case I want to stretch my legs and breathe planetary air and perhaps arrange for planetary food. I want Phelim to get the feel of a world again, too, and I think Pell would like to examine the woman at closer range.
Who? I? Said Pellerat, turning faintly pink. Not at all, Bliss, but I am the linguist of our little party.
Trevise shrugged. Come one, come all. Still, though she may look harmless, I intend to take my weapons with me.
I doubt, said Bliss, that you will be much tempted to use them on that young woman.
Trevise grinned. She is attractive, isn't she? Trevise left the ship first. Then Bliss, with one hand swung backward to enclose Phelim's, who carefully made her way down the ramp after Bliss. Pellerat was last. The black-haired young woman continued to watch with interest. She did not back away an inch. Trevise muttered, Well, let's try. He held his arms away from his weapons and said, I greet you. The young woman considered that for a moment and said,
I greet thee, and I greet thy companions.
Pellerat said joyfully, How wonderful! She speaks classical galactic, and with a correct accent. I understand her too, said Trevise, oscillating one hand to indicate his understanding wasn't perfect. I hope she understands me. He said, smiling and assuming a friendly expression, We come from across space. We come from another world.
That is well, said the young woman in her clear soprano. Comes thy ship from the Empire?
It comes from a far star, and the ship is named Far Star. The young woman looked up at the lettering on the ship.
Is that what that saith? If that be so, and if the first letter is an F, then, behold, it is imprinted backward.
Trevise was about to object, but Pellerat, in an ecstasy of joy, said, "She's right. The letter F did reverse itself about 2,000 years ago. What a marvelous chance to study classical galactic in detail and as a living language." Trevise studied the young woman carefully. She was not much more than 1.5 meters in height, and her breasts, though shapely, were small. Yet she did not seem unripe. The nipples were large, and the areoli dark, though that might be the result of her brownish skin color. He said, "My name is Golan Trevise. My friend is Janoff Pellerat. The woman is Bliss, and the child is Phelim." "Is it the custom, then, on the far star from which you come, that the men be given a double name? I am Hiroko, daughter of Hiroko."
"And your father?" interposed Pellerat suddenly.
To which Hiroko replied with an indifferent shrug of her shoulder,
"His name, so saith my mother, is Smool, but it is of no importance. I know him not."
"And where are the others?" asked Trevise. "You seem to be the only one to be here to greet us."
Hiroko said, "Many men are aboard the fish boats. Many women are in the fields. I take holiday these last 2 days, and so am fortunate enough to see this great thing. Yet people are curious, and the ship will have been seen as it descended, even from a distance. Others will be here soon."
"Are there many others on this island?"
"There are more than 65,000, said Hiroko with obvious pride.
"And are there other islands in the ocean?"
"Other islands, good sir?"
She seemed puzzled. Trevise took that as answer enough. This was the one spot on the entire planet that was inhabited by human beings. He said, "What do you call your world?"
"It is Alpha, good sir. We are taught that the whole name is Alpha Centauri, if that has more meaning to thee. But we call it Alpha only. And see, it is a fair-visaged world."
"A what world?" said Trevise, turning blankly to Pellerat.
"A beautiful world, she means," said Pellerat.
"That it is," said Trevise, "at least here and at this moment." He looked up at the mild blue morning sky with its occasional drift of clouds. "You have a nice sunny day, Hiroko, but I imagine there aren't many of those on Alpha."
Hiroko stiffened. "As many as we wish, sir. The clouds may come when we need rain, but on most days it seemeth good to us that the sky is fair above. Surely a goodly sky and a quiet wind are much to be desired on those days when the fish boats are at sea."
"Do your people control the weather, then, Hiroko?"
"Did we not, Sir Golan Trevise, we would be soggy with rain. Did we not, Sir Golan Trevise, we would be soggy with rain."
"But how do you do that?"
"Not being a trained engineer, sir, I cannot tell thee."
"And what might be the name of this island on which you and your people live?" said Trevise, finding himself trapped in the ornate sound of classical galactic, and wondering desperately if he had the conjugations right.
Hiroko said, "We call our heavenly island in the midst of the vast sea of waters New Earth."
At which Trevise and Pellerat stared at each other with surprise and delight. 76. There was no time to follow up on the statement. Others were arriving. Dozens. They must consist of those, Trevise thought, who were not on the ships or in the fields, and who were not from too far away. They came on foot for the most part,
though two ground cars were in evidence, rather old and clumsy. Clearly, this was a low-technology society, and yet they controlled the weather. It was well known that technology was not necessarily all of a piece, that lack of advance in some directions did not necessarily exclude considerable advance in others. But surely this example of uneven development was unusual. Of those who were now watching the ship, at least half were elderly men and women. There were also three or four children. Of the rest, more were women than men. None showed any fear or uncertainty whatever. Trevise said in a low voice to Bliss, "Are you manipulating them? They seem serene." "I'm not in the least manipulating them," said Bliss. "I never touch minds unless I must. It's Phallum I'm concerned with." Few as the newcomers were to anyone who had experienced the crowds of curiosity seekers on any normal world in the galaxy, they were a mob to Phallum, to whom the three adults on the far star had been something to grow accustomed to. Phallum was breathing rapidly and shallowly, and her eyes were half closed. Almost she seemed in shock. Bliss was stroking her, softly and rhythmically, and making soothing sounds. Trevise was certain that she was delicately accompanying it all by an infinitely gentle rearrangement of mental fibrils. Phallum took in a sudden deep breath, almost a gasp, and shook herself in what was perhaps an involuntary shudder. She raised her head and looked at those present with something approaching normality, and then buried her head in the space between Bliss's arm and body. Bliss let her remain so, while her arm, encircling Phallum's shoulder, tightened periodically, as though to indicate her own protective presence over and over. Pellerat seemed rather awestruck as his eyes went from one Alphan to another. He said, "Golan, they differ so among themselves." Trevise had noticed that too. There were various shades of skin and hair color, including one brilliant redhead with blue eyes and freckled skin. At least three apparent adults were as short as Hiroko, and one or two were taller than Trevise. A number of both sexes had eyes resembling those of Hiroko, and Trevise remembered that on the teeming commercial planets of the Fili sector, such eyes were characteristic of the population, but he had never visited that sector. All the Elfins wore nothing above the waist, and among the women, the breasts all seemed to be small. That was the most nearly uniform of all the bodily characteristics that he could see. Bliss said suddenly, "Miss Hiroko, my youngster is not accustomed to travel through space, and she is absorbing more novelty than she can easily manage. Would it be possible for her to sit down and, perhaps, have something to eat and drink?" Hiroko looked puzzled, and Pellerat repeated what Bliss had said in the more ornate galactic of the mid-imperial period. Hiroko's hand then flew to her mouth, and she sank to her knees gracefully. "I crave your pardon, respected madam," she said. "I have not thought of this child's needs, nor of thine. The strangeness of this event has too occupied me. Wouldst thou, would you all, as visitors and guests, enter the refectory for morning meal? May we join you and serve as hosts?" Bliss said, "That is kind of you." She spoke slowly and pronounced the words carefully, hoping to make them easier to understand. "It would be better, though, if you alone served as hostess, for the sake of the comfort of the child, who is unaccustomed to being with many people at once." Hiroko rose to her feet. "It shall be as thou hast said." She led them in leisurely manner across the grass. Other Alphans edged closer. They seemed particularly interested in the clothing of the newcomers. Trevise removed his light jacket and handed it to a man who had sidled toward him and had laid a questing finger upon it. "Here," he said.